Mr. Mitchell, please go ahead. It please the court. Thank you very much. As an amici,
I keep your voice up.
Sorry about that. Got a little frog in my throat here, I think. As an amici for the Office of Parental Representation, we're not seeking to add another voice to the dubious or questioned character of shaken baby syndrome evidence as established at the Frye hearing and adopted by the two thoughtful opinions in the courts below. Instead, what we hope to do is assist this court by stressing that those decisions are wholly consistent with the often pathmarking foundation of this court's child welfare jurisprudence of the last 20 years. And I say that importantly to stress that this court has staked out issues in the eight or so cases that we discussed in our amicus brief that really are pathmarking and set a course much like the decision of the trial court and the appellate division here did. And those cases that we cite to this court show that barring, and this is, I think, important after the Attorney General's office suggestion to the contrary, that barring SBS evidence, shaken baby syndrome evidence, will not disarm child protection agencies that protect children, nor cause children to go unprotected. This court has made that point in numerous cases in its pathmarking child welfare decisions, that there are tools available, ample tools available to child protection agencies, such that in JRR, this court rejected 30 years of appellate jurisprudence in the state in holding that that evidence had to establish who did what to a child, not that the defendants had a burden of proof, the shifted burden of proof. That jurisprudence was out the window. And this court decision in JRR was really pathmarking in that regard. And instead, this court has insisted on reliable evidence in child welfare cases. And here, that means that a family who learns a child has been injured should not be subjected to the kind of speculation that is entailed in shaken baby syndrome cases. As a diagnosis, it's not a diagnosis for medical purposes. It's a diagnosis that doesn't provide any help in treating. It's really a legally formulated diagnosis. And I think that's perhaps the difference that I would stake out from what the Attorney General's office suggested to this court as a medical diagnosis. It doesn't assist medical doctors in treating a child. It simply provides a speculative cause for that child's injuries, but can't provide the actual evidence of causation.
Yes, I don't understand that. Are you saying the doctor's not treating a subdural hemorrhage, or the doctor's not treating a retinal hemorrhage?
No, the doctors are treating those things, but those things are simply the medical conditions identified. They aren't the causation of the supposedly violent shaking that led to those conditions. So the doctors are treating the underlying condition, but the underlying condition doesn't necessarily explain the cause. It's a leap, and I think that's an important point. And certainly it was, I think, important for the courts below, both the trial court and the appellate panel. And I think what we would urge the court to remember that, and I'm sure the court is conscious of this, that SBS theories, shaken baby syndrome theories, involve a threat to liberty even outside the context of a criminal case. They're a threat to liberty from a legal determination that child abuse has occurred, if that can be the predicate for a Title IX finding. And it may even lead to termination of parental rights case. In fact, in going back to the GL case, which is cited in our brief, that there was a backdrop in that case of shaken baby syndrome because the mother, whose parental rights were at stake, refused to believe the diagnosis that was made with regard to the death of a child 5 years earlier, attributed to her husband's, the child's father, shaking the baby. And she did not believe that. And yet a child protection action to terminate parental rights was brought against her. It was a kind of the contagion of shaking baby syndrome, you might say. A termination of parental rights action was brought against her for disbelieving the diagnosis. And this court said what she thought was not a proper basis for termination of parental rights. But in the background of GL was this shaken baby syndrome lurking. Much as in JRR, there was a shaken baby diagnosis given that the parents had to disprove until this court reversed that decision and said, no, parents don't carry the burden of proof. That doesn't shift. So the gravamen of our argument is that shaken baby syndrome should no longer be able to have that kind of destructive force for families. It doesn't necessarily protect families. It can lead to destructive forces in the child welfare system. And this court's body of child welfare law has rejected the notion that evidence based on, and we can use any kind of words here, speculation, surmise, conjecture, has no proper function in protecting children. And that is very similar in all the eight cases that we discussed, very similar to what the appellate division here held, that evidence as to causation, not evidence of that the child was injured. Those are facts, right? That the leap here, the speculative leap, is one to causation, and that's where both in the criminal case realm and in child welfare law, that this court has held more is required. Evidence of actual untoward conduct is what is the basis of a child protection case. It should not be speculation or conjecture or surmise. the other focus of, I think the problem with SBS evidence is when it becomes a proxy for causation, it provides a disincentive for getting help for a child. It too easily shields limited investigation, other causes of harm, even medical malfeasance, and all at the expense of families. And this is because SBS uses patterns of pathology to attribute causation to the supposed shaking that is speculated as to have occurred. We don't know if that actually occurred. We don't know what the cause is. And that's where the Attorney General's office in the argument, her argument mentioned, we have two things that this kind of evidence looks to: what cannot be explained and what can be explained. If the SBS evidence actually explained something, instead of leaping to a speculative conclusion, we wouldn't be here. None of us would be here. But what the evidence does is it basically says we don't know. Is it an answer that sounds, given its pedigree, it sounds authoritative? But what we have is a simple throwing up the hands. It's an answer to an unexplained conclusion. And in doing so, SBS theories conceal rather than reveal. They conceal that causes of the intracranial pathology, the retinal hemorrhaging, remain uncertain and incomplete. And those kinds of sketchy theories should not be considered as evidence. And it was why the appellate division here was, I think, correct in suggesting the evidence would be inadmissible. So what we have, I'll conclude here because I realize I'm limited to my 5 minutes, Your Honor. What we have in SBS theories is a desire to explain a child's condition. Again, that's rooted in conjecture. That kind of conjecture this court has held has no place in evidence to protect children. That's all the appellate division decision here demands. that evidence to protect children must rest on facts and not speculation. That proof of causation and culpability for intracranial and retinal findings must be based on facts, not speculation about a violent shaking. If the court has any questions, I'll be glad to try and.
Thank you, Mr. Bond.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Liston, rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd actually like to work backwards, addressing the Office of Parental Representation's concern. I just would like to remind the court that parents are not the only ones who may cause abusive head trauma. If evidence like Dr. Medina's testimony is excluded, parents would have no recourse against an abusive daycare worker, for an example. And in fact, in a scenario discussed when Mr. Mason was up here, I believe even if there was corroborating evidence of abuse, that testimony would still be inadmissible. Again, just thinking of the situation with a daycare worker, that's should be a great concern to parents. Families in general. Going back to Mr. Mason's argument, I just have to redirect the court's attention as.
Sorry, can I ask one follow-up question about something that Mr. Mitchell had said? He said that SPS is not a medical diagnosis because it doesn't assist doctors in treating the child. It is simply speculation as to causation. How do you respond to that?
I would disagree again with the treatment may be consultation with the parent as far as how they're treating their children, perhaps the parent not recognizing the danger of their behavior to the child. Not to mention, as I believe Justice Hoffman pointed out, you know, there will be treatment of the subdural hemorrhages, severe retinal hemorrhages, whatever symptoms there may be, you know, if there are, you know, bruises, fractures, ligamentous injury, anything like that. Obviously, there would be treatment that goes along with that.
But are there other medical diagnoses that are like this, that the diagnosis is not about how to treat the patient, it's about legal causation?
Medical diagnosis.
Correct. A lot of the amicus briefs also raise this, that, you know, this is not a medical diagnosis. This is a legal causation, an opinion on legal causation that's masquerading as a medical diagnosis. How do you respond to that? Is this unique in all medical diagnoses? This is the only one that's just about causation and not about future treatment. Are there other medical diagnoses that are similar? How do you respond?
In terms of the causation, frankly, nothing comes to mind as an analogy, regretfully, but it is evidence, you know, certainly circumstantial evidence in terms of the culpability of a particular person. I can't think of a good analogy, to be honest.
Why though? Why is it evidence of culpability of a particular person, other than by speculation that they may have been one of the few people that were with the child alone?
Well, that, Your Honor, the state would argue that that's not speculation, rather it's circumstantial evidence, you know, a process of elimination whereby, you know, the subject to cross-examination, of course, but where the state presents evidence that certain injuries occurred and they don't occur except, you know, in cases of extreme accident, which haven't, you know, there's nothing in the record about that. Whatever other circumstances, doctor provides an opinion that certain injuries were caused by inflicted trauma, provides evidence that injuries of this kind, specifically the encephalopathy, the timing indicates that, you know, the cause of the encephalopathy occurred at a particular time. There was only one person who was with the victim that time, and that's the evidence that particular person was responsible.
And absent some indication by that individual that there was some negligence or an accident, isn't there now a presumption of intent? Therefore, because they're essentially not explaining how they may have dropped the child. So the only other alternative, if there's a finding of SBS, is that there must have been some secret intent to harm the child. Isn't that what ends up happening when the diagnosis is issued?
Well, I guess, you know, we're getting into a mens rea element, which that's something separate. I mean, really, all the state's attempting to do is explain causation. And then, you know, the reasonable inferences that can be drawn from the evidence of that causation may not satisfy your honor as far as the answer to that question. But I guess no, in terms of whether there's any mens rea attached to it. I guess it's really just the causation of what force caused these injuries.
But as to the causation, it seems like you conceded that this is unique in that it's not like other medical diagnoses. It exists just to prove causation in a legal proceeding.
Right. Well, in terms of we have, you know, what it would look like at a trial would be, you know, the individual doctors who made the diagnosis, the ophthalmologist who found the severe retinal hemorrhages, radiologist who saw the subdural hemorrhages, and then the various doctors who you know, gave their own opinion, ruled out certain other causes, and then finally Dr. Medina, who ties it all together and say, having with all of these findings, having excluded everything else, my opinion is these injuries resulted from inflicted trauma.
I understand. My question was just, it seemed like you were conceding that opinion is unique and is not the same as other medical diagnoses, which are generally for the purpose of treatment and not for the purpose of legal culpability.
I'm conceding I can't think of another one, but it is possible there is one, being candid with the court, and that I haven't been able to think of one.
Counsel, you just used the phrase, as in this case, to tie the father to the diagnosis of encephalopathy. But if I recall the articles that I was reading, that type of, that the presentation of those symptoms can occur based upon events that occur over a course of days, if not a week. So how can it be that, as in this case, we tie the father to causing encephalopathy, if in fact that could have been caused over the course of days, if not a week, and it wasn't just the father that was with the baby for that those course of days or the week, it happened to be the father that was with the baby when the baby exhibited those acute symptoms?
Well, I guess the way the narrative presented itself to Dr. Medina was, again, there were three separate diaper changes where what was reported by the parents, both of them, was that the father was with the child and he started exhibiting these symptoms on each of these three occasions. So, you know, Dr. Medina's opinion was that the encephalopathy or altered mental status, seizure-like activity, those were associated with those three times when, if they were caused by something else, you know, they would have occurred at random times. Maybe it's this extreme coincidence, but Dr. Medina's opinion was, especially since they did a video encephalogram at the hospital, no seizure-like activity at all in the 2 weeks or so that the child was at the hospital under observation, and yet they occurred right when the father was doing these diaper changes on these three separate incidents. So that's Dr. Medina's opinion as far as the connection between the altered mental status, encephalopathy, and the father's presence. But again, Your Honor, that I just would like to point out that gets to, you know, the particular defendant's culpability rather than what's at issue right now, which is just the general acceptance of abusive head trauma as a diagnosis in that diagnostic process.
But didn't those facts contribute to her conclusion that this was shaken baby syndrome?
Abusive head trauma. Yes, that was part of Dr. Medina's consideration.
But it doesn't just go to mens rea unless you're conceding, which I'm sure you're not, that the intention of this report is to identify mens rea.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I thought Your Honor was inquiring about the identifying a particular person as the person who caused the abuse of head trauma. So again, that's the connection there in Dr. Medina's opinion, as the state understands it.
How do you respond to Mr. Mason's argument that AHT and SBS are different and the state keeps conflating them? And while there might be some scientific support for AHT, there is not support for SBS, and the state keeps trying to bootstrap support for AHT into support for SBS.
I would say Mr. Mason has that backwards. As the state has argued repeatedly to this court, to the appellate division, just read what Dr. Medina's diagnosis was: abusive head trauma, as occurs in a shaking event with or without impact. In other words, abusive head trauma, here's a possible mechanism. So the state has never said, Dr. Medina said, shaking only. And it was frustrating to read that in the appellate division's opinion right from the beginning, saying Dr.
Medina. I thought his point, sorry, was that shaking only, or shaking with impact on a soft surface for which there is no external sign, is the same. And that's SBS. And that the state keeps trying to conflate that with AHT, which can involve lots of external signs of injury.
May or may not. I mean, there is evidence submitted by Dr. Van E, our studies, and I think it's been discussed today, indicating there can be impact even on a hard surface without signs of impact initially that aren't visible until autopsy.
Did I understand you to be saying that Dr. Medina's opinion was not an opinion that there was SHS in this case? Was something different from that?
SHS?
Shaken baby syndrome. SBS. Yeah.
Well, what Dr. Medina diagnosed was abusive head trauma, which used to be called shaken baby syndrome. And shaking alone or with impact is still generally accepted in the medical community as possible causes of abusive head trauma.
Sorry, so you're saying SBS and AHT are the same?
No.
SBS used to be called AHT, used to be called SBS, I thought is what you just said.
It's right, but it's really just a name. The visual of a shaken baby, I guess, has stuck, and it's a shame because abusive head trauma is more accurate.
So I think what Mr. Mason was arguing was that abusive head trauma generally encompasses a lot of different types of head trauma that can happen in a lot of various ways. And I believe his argument was a lot of the studies and a lot of the literature that the state is relying on discusses abusive head trauma generally and the acceptance of abusive head trauma generally and not specifically shaken baby syndrome, which is what we're focused on here. That was his argument. So how do you respond to that? That a lot of what the state is relying on is general abusive head trauma that can happen in a variety of different ways, children, adults, everyone, not shaken baby syndrome and the acceptance and reliability of that.
Well, I would say that the medical community doesn't make that same distinction. I mean, that there may, if there is enough known.
Shouldn't there be that distinction? Because we've talked at length today about the differences between, I think even you mentioned in your argument initially, babies and infants are not just smaller adults. So there's a big difference between how their bodies react and their brain reacts to different trauma, different acceleration, deceleration. So shouldn't there be a distinction? And that's what the defense is arguing, that distinction is not being made. And therein lies possibly why many of these medical organizations are generally accepting of abusive head trauma when there's not specific focus on shaken baby syndrome.
Well, again, the medical community does generally accept that shaking alone can cause the symptoms traditionally associated with abusive trauma.
I think one of the things we're having trouble understanding, yeah, is AHT something much more general than shaken baby syndrome? Like if an adult is hit on the head with a brick, could that be AHT because it's abusive head trauma? Or is abusive head trauma only used by doctors to describe shaking an infant that causes these symptoms?
So let me say this. I mean, the CDC defines abusive head trauma really only talking about children, like infants.
Okay.
So abusive head trauma is something that they don't use in reference to adults. And maybe, I guess, that's, you could call it a flaw in the in what it's named. But I hope that clarifies somewhat on that point. But as far as shaken baby syndrome, Mr. Mason did accurately describe it as a subset of abusive head trauma. But bringing it back to this case and what Dr. Medina actually diagnosed, it was abusive head trauma, providing shaking as a possible mechanism, but not definitely that. And as far as the shaking against a soft surface, that came about in cross-examination in response to, you know, a question like, could shaking with impact leave no visible signs of injury? And it was Dr. Medina said yes, if there was shaking impact against a soft surface.
So is Dr. Medina's opinion that this was a case of shaken baby syndrome, or was she saying it's AHT and one possible cause of it was shaken baby syndrome?
The latter. In fact, her words in her report were abusive head trauma, as occurs with a shaking event,
without impact. And that was the opinion that was stricken in this case.
Right.
By the trial court.
Can you go back one step and give us a succinct statement of your position as to the difference between shaken baby syndrome and AHT?
The difference, well, a name and when that change occurred, it's a little bit confusing because what's used.
I'm sorry, but you just said SBS is a subset of AHT.
Oh, well.
So what is the difference? Because if something is a subset of something else, that means that
not the same.
They're not the same.
Right.
So what does that mean?
As far as the subset part, I understand your Honor's question. So I guess where the mechanism of shaking is known to some degree.
Which are you referring to now?
Oh, shaken baby syndrome.
Go ahead. Give us a succinct statement of what that is and how it's distinct from AHT.
Your Honor, I will give you the state's position on that. However, I would ask that Your Honor refer to medical literature on the answer to that question. But shaken baby syndrome, let's say a form of abusive head trauma where shaking is the mechanism of injury.
As opposed to AHT, which is what?
Which is a traumatic brain injury to an infant skull caused by inflicted trauma from blunt impact or shaking with impact or a crushing event.
If an infant is in an accidental car accident, is the diagnosis AHT?
No, because there's no abuse, and that, assuming it's known to the doctor, that would be something that would, you know.
So it's just about whether there's impact against a hard surface when someone is shaking?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, can you repeat that question?
Just again, trying to figure out the difference between AHT and SBS. Is the only difference that in AHT, there's impact against a hard surface while there's shaking?
Shaking is a possible mechanism of abusive head trauma.
Shaking alone.
Yes.
I thought you said that's SBS and shaking alone is not AHT. So that's what I'm trying to figure out. How is AHT broader than SBS? If SBS is a subset of AHT, then what constitutes AHT that does not constitute SBS? How is it broader?
It includes other possible mechanisms of injury.
Which are what?
Blunt impact and crushing, in addition to shaking as another alternative.
Is AHT limited to infants?
I'm sorry, what was that?
AHT limited to infants?
Yes, in fact, if you'll allow me to take a, actually, no, I think I have it. No, I don't. I did get the latest CDC definition of abusive head trauma. This is from the CDC website, last updated May 16th, 2024. What is abusive head trauma? Abusive head trauma, including shaken baby syndrome, is a severe form of child abuse that results in a brain injury. It often happens when a parent or caregiver becomes angry or frustrated because of a child's crying. It is caused by violent shaking and/or with blunt impact. The resulting injury can cause bleeding around the brain or behind the eyes.
So, Counselor, what's the difference then between AHT and shaken baby syndrome with or without impact?
Well, the shaken baby syndrome is subsumed within the broader abusive head trauma diagnosis.
I want to make sure you're answering my exact question. Mm-hmm. The difference between AHT and shaken baby syndrome with or without impact. What's the difference?
Well, one is part of, is a form of the other. Shaken baby syndrome is a form of abusive head trauma.
Is shaken baby syndrome, as you, on behalf of the state, define it, entail conduct that involves with or without impact?
Those are both possible forms of abusive head trauma.
I'm asking about shaken baby syndrome. You've already given us that answer for AHT, and we're trying to distinguish between the two. SBS, at its core, involves what, according to the state? Shaking?
Mm-hmm.
And anything else? Any qualification to shaking? Is it both with and without impact?
I believe so, yes. But again,
it seemed like the definition for AHT also said violent shaking and or blunt impact. So I think that's where we're not understanding. It seems like the definitions are the same. Shaking with or without impact, shaking and or impact.
You can also tell us where we should precisely look for it instead of continuing this, if that would be more productive. Take your pick.
Right, well, again, I would ask your honors to listen to scientists, not lawyers. But
we want people to listen to lawyers too. But
at least in determining scientific reliability.
Where should we look specifically to parse the difference between these two important terms?
Well, there's the CDC website. Actually, I don't have a specific web address. Dr. Medina's testimony, which also in defining abusive head trauma, she cited the CDC. Her wording differed slightly from what is there now, but the same basic idea. I know that this is cited in the state's brief, of course, in the transcript 4T, as far as the exact page, I would need a minute with that. 4T is the September 24th, 2020 transcript toward the beginning of Dr. Medina's testimony. It basically starts out that what is abusive head trauma? She provides an answer citing the CDC.
So, Counselor, when these studies are just referring to AHT, they could be referring to shaken baby syndrome with impact, and they could be referring to shaken baby syndrome without impact, right?
Yes, but it depends on the study. Like, for instance, the Vincent studies, the confession studies we've been talking about, the point of a lot of those was to determine whether shaking alone could cause the symptoms associated, the intracranial symptoms associated with abusive head trauma. So that would be called, in those cases, that would be called shaken baby syndrome. The name would be more appropriate there because what they were looking at was confessions or independently witnessed shaking. So,
unless it's qualified, if we just see AHT, we should assume that they're talking about a situation in which there may have been or may not have been impact.
Correct. If that's as far as the description goes.
So what forms of AHT exist that are not shaken baby syndrome?
Well, again, the CDC would...
Subset, obviously, if you'd have a Venn diagram, you'd have one within the other.
Mm-hmm. The ones that Dr. Medina cited were, blunt impact, crushing, then shaking with or without impact. Of course, blunt impact could mean a lot of different things.
As well as shaking alone.
Right, another possible mechanism of the traumatic injury.
So there's sort of four categories: crushing, blunt impact, shaking without impact, all under the umbrella of AHT?
Correct, Your Honor.
And would you say that one of the key differences then is that shaking alone is one of the only ones of the ones that have just been described that shows no external evidence?
Right. There may be cases where it does, in terms of you can do broken ribs from, this is if you have a confession where a defendant describes, I grabbed him by the rib cage and shook like this, then you might have, bruise marks, broken ribs that don't.
But specifically going to the triad and what we've been discussing today, we've got shaking alone and without impact, right? As distinct from shaking alone with impact, and the others you defined in terms of crushing or compressing in some way, the others would all have external indicators.
Not necessarily. Again, there may be impact that leaves no visible mark, as even Dr. Vanney agreed. Nothing visible until autopsy, if one unfortunately becomes necessary.
Can you give us an example where there is no overlap between the two terms?
I guess a case where there's corroboration, some satisfactory witness account, and enough evidence to say shaking alone was definitely the only mechanism of injury.
We would need to turn to an independent separate witness to make a determination about this medical term?
You're asking if we would have to do that?
Yes.
Or some video evidence, if it existed. I think the point is that if we would need a basis for deciding that shaking was definitely the mechanism. But what the AHT diagnosis deals
with. But if it's a subset, then all cases of shaken baby syndrome are AHT cases, but not all cases of AHT are shaken baby syndrome, right?
Correct.
It's sort of the definition of a subset.
Right.
You rely upon the Compton case in your briefing. That's shaken baby syndrome with impact.
I believe so. I mean, it's this state only cited it as an example of where, the diagnosis was accepted as reliable. I mean,
that's with impact, right? The baby's dropped from 7 feet. The medical examiner says shaking alone could not have caused this injury. So it's quite a distinguishable fact pattern. Wouldn't you agree than the fact patterns we have before us?
As Your Honor described it, yes. But I guess it, just in terms of coming back to the question of general acceptance, how abusive head trauma is defined within the medical community, whether it's generally accepted as reliable, and again, the process of identifying inflicted trauma as the cause of the injuries, that's what's under review here. Then that methodology is generally accepted.
Counsel, on the question that was posed earlier to your colleagues across the aisle, who decides general acceptance within the scientific community under Frye? Medical community or the courts?
Medical community. Scientists, that would be the state's position.
General acceptance under Frye is decided by doctors?
Well, not... scientists, that's for sure. The state's understanding of this.
Respectfully, then, what are we doing here? If that were true,
the
question of admissibility and general acceptance that lies at the core of it under Frye is a question of legal admissibility. Who decides that? The medical community or the courts on the critical question of general acceptance?
I'm sorry, I misunderstood Your Honor's question. Yes, the courts decide what has been generally accepted within the relevant scientific community. And that was, I quoted Harvey, I know in my earlier statement, or no, it was...
Harvey quoted Fry, it's the court makes a here's evidence of what is generally accepted in the medical community, ultimately the court's decision.
Right, but I'm sorry, I'm thinking of the quote from State v. Cavallo saying, judges are not, paraphrasing now, judges are not good at determining, or not qualified to determine what is scientifically reliable, but they can determine what has been generally accepted within the scientific community as scientifically reliable.
That cuts against Daubert a bit, doesn't it?
Yes, and that's, you know, the court is understandably moved toward Daubert, which empowers direct examination. Right, and that, I guess, would be an argument in favor of the alternative special master proposal, if that is considered by the court to be a superior approach to determining the reliability of scientific evidence, then this very important subject is worthy of.
We would have to turn away from the language in Olenowski 1 that says its ruling is prospective only in order to get there. Is that fair?
In order to get to the remand?
In order to conduct a Daubert hearing now on remand, your alternative proposal.
Oh, well, just seems like the right thing. the state's primary position is it established general acceptance under the Fry test, and the appellate division should be reversed. But if the court sees a problem with, well, it was not such a big deal in Olenowski because we had medicine and toxicology as two fields of inquiry relevant to the general acceptance question. It didn't seem to cause a problem there, but here obviously there is, does it seem to be a dispute, you know, which is the relevant community, if it's both, how much weight should be given to each. A Daubert analysis could avoid that.
Is your problem. Position consistent with the language in Olenowski 1?
Regarding
prospectivity only.
Yes. I mean, the state submitted some a biomechanical study. I mean, there is the fact that the state has a biomechanical expert who could testify that studies actually do support the abusive head trauma diagnosis.
Sorry, I thought your fallback position was that there should be a special master to decide admissibility under Fry. Are you saying it's actually that there should be a special adjudicator to decide admissibility under Daubert?
Yes, that was what the state requested.
Also, can I say what I'm struggling with? Is you seem to be saying, for these purposes, there really is no difference between the with or without impact part. But it would seem to me, going back to what we talked about earlier, that biomechanics would play a very different role if it was a case with impact or a case without impact. Because if it's just pure shaking, biomechanics seems to be much more relevant than it would be if it was a case of shaking with impact. And I guess I'm just asking you, how do you respond to that?
I guess I hate to give the same answer I believe I gave before, but I guess the shaking with impact is something that biomechanical engineers would be more supportive of. The question seems to be
supportive of what?
Oh, if there were a diagnosis made, you know, a shaking with impact, biomechanical engineers seem to agree that that's at least that impact can cause the injuries associated with abusive head trauma, subdural hemorrhages, severe retinal hemorrhages, whereas there is less agreement on shaking alone as a mechanism of injury. So in terms of the relevance of biomechanics, I guess that's where I think that's where biomechanical engineers would stand on that.
So if there's less agreement, to a mathematical certainty, there would be, if there's less agreement, there's less certainty, right?
If we're considering the biomechanics opinion on that, then But then yes, but.
And we all agree biomechanics does play a role in this. So one of the factors that does play a role in this, there would be less certainty if we were just talking about shaking as opposed to shaking with impact, right?
I think there'd be more biomechanical experts willing to accept the impact as the cause of the injuries. If that's what Your Honor's getting at, is there more biomechanical support for shaking alone versus shaking with impact?
But your expert phrased it as with or without. In other words, right. Your expert didn't testify in my medical opinion, reasonable degree of medical certainty. I consider this to be a case of shaking with impact.
Right.
It was shaking with or without impact. And so what I think you're saying is that shaking with impact has a very solid consensus, even in biomechanics.
It has more support. Again, Dr. Vanney didn't seem to question, or had less question about impact as a cause, where there's impact involved.
Are you conceding that Dr. Van E is we discussed how, or maybe we didn't ask you this, is there a society of biomechanical engineers?
Not that the state is aware of, no.
So are you agreeing that Dr. Van E is representative of biomechanical engineers as a whole, or is he just one individual testifying?
Well, he's one individual testifying. There are other biomechanical engineers who consider abusive head trauma, you know, shaking alone as a mechanism of abusive head trauma, consider that to be reliable, a real diagnosis. Those same biomechanical engineers would agree with Dr. Vanney about there being not a consensus, you know, so it sort of depends on the biomechanical engineer you ask about that question as far as whether it's been sufficiently proven. No society that the state's aware of.
So in order to assess reliability, don't we need to know whether Dr. Medina thinks there was or was not impact?
Not the state does not agree with that.
Presumably, if she was certain of that, the answer to Justice Hoffman's question, she would have testified one way or the other.
Right.
And I think her testimony reflects that she didn't know the answer to that.
Correct.
So she did this sort of either or testimony.
Correct. But she did not want to speculate. I know the word speculation has come up a lot.
And yet it seems that a pretty broad motion was made to bar a whole category of testimony in all cases that may or may not have been implicated by this particular case. Am I right about that?
Yes, state would agree with that.
So it goes beyond this individual case, what is being sought to be barred here.
Yes. If, depending on the reading of the, you know, opinion, however, it's expressed.
Does this record support an inquiry by this court as to the reliability under Frye of a subcategory, which we could, for purposes of the discussion, call AHT with shaking, but no evidence of trauma? See what I'm saying?
You said no evidence of trauma, meaning no evidence of impact?
No, I'm sorry, no evidence of impact. I apologize. See what I'm saying? She had this sort of fork in the road, either or opinion. But I think what you're saying is that one of her two alternative scenarios is quite solidly supported by biomechanics. And obviously both are supported by the Academy of Pediatrics and so forth. Did the issue come up about her opinion because she included shaking without impact as well as shaking with impact?
Well, I can say that the defendant has argued and that the state was required to prove shaking alone is a reliable diagnosis, whereas the state has pointed to Dr. Medina's actual words, which included the possibility of of impact.
There's no evidence of impact in this case, is there?
Nothing visible, correct.
So doesn't that help us as to the relevance of Dr. Medina's testimony? It was about no impact.
But again, there is the testimony of even Dr. Van E that there may have been impact and that just didn't leave a visible mark, which often happens. The consensus statement talks about it, that are only visible on autopsy. Same thing with neck injury. It's been argued that if a child was shaken with enough force to cause these intracranial injuries, you would have seen neck injury. In this case, there was no neck imaging, and Dr. Scheller even testified that a dedicated MRI image of the neck might have shown neck injury, but there wasn't one done in this case. So
doesn't that take us to one of the critical reasons why Dr. Medina's testimony was important in this case for the state, to provide testimony about an incident without impact, without visible evidence of impact?
The testimony would be that the child suffered injuries that weren't visible on the outside, or intracranial, the severe retinal hemorrhages, subdural hemorrhages, and the encephalopathy, which Dr. Medina attributed to the abuse. So,
and she did explore that in her testimony.
The encephalopathy aspect, or
the absence of evidence of impact, visible evidence.
Right. It was noted. Yeah, I think in direct and certainly on cross-examination.
I know we've kept you up here for quite some time. Is there something else we steered you away from that you had hoped to touch upon?
I did mention the issue of the neck and this assumption that there was no neck injury.
Can I ask one more question?
Yes.
I'm looking at the trial court's opinion, and the trial court excluded AHT. Am I right about that?
Yes.
And you're saying, and I think there seems to be agreement, that SBS is a subset of AHT. And there seems to be agreement that there are aspects to AHT that are not really even disputed in terms of their ability to their general acceptance. Am I right about that as well?
I think I speak for defendant when we say yes.
So did the trial court paint with too broad a brush, to use a non-medical term?
Yes, Dave certainly believes the court did.
Can I just clarify on that same issue? I mean, it sounded to me like Mr. Mason got up and said the one critical question was the scientific reliability of SBS and HT without impact. It was isolated that way. Are you all on the same page that that's what we're talking about?
Well, no, in that, again, the state's position is reading Dr. Dita's actual testimony. Her diagnosis was abusive head trauma. It was intended to be broad, recognizing that it could have, there could have been a couple different mechanisms of injury. But what she did know is that these types of injury don't occur, or didn't occur in this case, by any natural cause. And inflicted injury was what the doctor concluded. Coming back to Justice Wiener Apter's, there was questioning regarding, why do doctors still accept this? And the state's answer would be because it's still reliable. The example was given regarding peanuts and what doctors advise parents they should do in terms of introducing peanuts. Yes, turns out we were wrong to say they shouldn't have introduced him early on. That, along with, there was a period of time where parents were told, have your child sleep on their stomach, and then change that into, no, actually, it should be on the back. I think the point is that doctors do follow the science. They will change. And abusive head trauma has stood the test of time. All these studies have been considered by doctors, and they still generally accept it. So I think this court can trust the doctors would not generally accept an unreliable diagnosis, and they haven't done so in this case.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
Thank you to all counsel for the very helpful arguments and the obvious preparation into this. We will take the matter under advisement.